Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special election edition of Your Call. It's actually our last special election show because we just have 5 days until the election. By now, you have received your ballot guide, which feels more like a phone book. We are voting on many important measures, propositions, and races. And we've got some good information over at kalw.org. I just got a couple of emails from listeners saying, where can we find all of the voting information in one simple place? Well, if you go to kalw.org, on the right-hand side, you will see a box that says Election Guide. Click on that, and then all of the shows that we've done, all the reports that you've heard from Cross Currents are in that one place. And then you can all also print out a one-page crib sheet of San Francisco ballot measures and California propositions and take that with you to the polling place. Much, much easier than taking in that huge booklet or trying to figure it all out at the last minute. So that's at kalw.org. And then I hope you can join us for our special election night coverage. We'll be at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco from 7 to 9 o'clock. I'll be there, and then Ben Trefney will be hosting a special call-in show on KALW from 9 until 11 p.m., and you can find information at KALW's Facebook page. Today, we're opening the lines to take your last-minute questions. If you have any questions about polling places, absentee voting, if you haven't received something yet or you can't get through to a registrar's office, we'd love to take your call. Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Kim Alexander, founder and president of the California Voter Foundation. That's a nonpartisan organization working to improve the election process so that it better serves our needs and interests. Hi, Kim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Last time we had you on, we were inundated with phone calls, and so we wanted to have you back to answer questions. And before we get to calls and emails, since you follow these issues so closely, is there anything going on behind the scenes right now that we should know about with ballot problems or polling place problems? Anything happening?
The thing I'm keeping an eye on right now is I know that some counties are having, I know my own county is having some difficulty processing many of the paper voter registration applications that have come in through groups that do voter registration programs. They had, just in Sacramento County alone, on Monday last week, had about 1,000 applications they could not process because they were for addresses that did not exist. And so then another batch came in at the very close of the registration period. And so those folks that this group, Democracy Resources, went out and registered think that they're registered to vote, but the county cannot put their name on the rolls because their forms were incomplete. And so they're, you know, if they show up at the polls and want to vote, they'll have to vote a provisional ballot, and the county will try to update their record at that point. But I don't think they're the only county that's dealing with this. There was a lot of voter registration activity right up until the deadline on October 24th, and I know many counties are still processing those paper applications. So people might be checking to see, like we had a call today from someone saying, I registered to vote close to the deadline, I haven't gotten anything, you know, I'm not registered yet. I mean, you can go online and check and see if your registration has gone through. And the counties are, you know, cranking out ballots as quickly as they can. But if you registered close to the deadline, especially if you did it on paper and they've got to key all that in, data enter it, and you requested a vote by mail ballot, they will issue it, but you'll probably get it too late to be able to actually return it by mail. You need to return it in person.
Okay, so if you go in and they don't have your name, you do have the right to vote with a provisional ballot?
That's right, and this is a challenge we saw in the primary election, too, where there also was a lot of last-minute voter registration activity and people switching their party preference. We want to make sure voters know you don't have to have a special party preference for this election to vote for whoever you want. It was only in the primary, which is a question we're getting from voters too. But in the primary, people were switching their party affiliation very close to the deadline. And then the counties, you know, often were already printing out their rosters for the polling places while they were still processing voter registration applications and updates. And so that's why some people may not be on the roster. If you go to your polling place and you're not on the roster, you should ask the poll worker if there's a supplemental roster, because those often get issued by counties for those late processed registrations, but not all the poll workers are aware. They have so many things that they're dealing with that sometimes they overlook the fact that there's this supplemental roster. So, you know, and I think it's challenging for voters because you go into a polling place and you assume the person behind the table is an expert and knows everything that's going on. And often, you know, there are people who are essentially volunteers who are very dedicated to their job but have a lot of responsibilities and a lot of information they have to manage. And so, you know, the important thing is to ask for help, ask for a supervisor. If you really think there's a problem, insist that they contact the county election office or call them yourself and get your problem settled.
And Kim, if you don't see your name on the list, you do have a right to vote with a provisional ballot, but at that point, do you need an ID?
No, you don't need an ID, but if you go to vote, and you know, people vote provisional ballots for a lot of reasons. Sometimes people forgot to register to vote and before the deadline and they still want to vote, and you can go to your polling place and vote, but your ballot is not going to be counted unless you're legally registered to vote. But if you believe you are legally registered to vote, or if you were issued a vote by mail ballot and you lost it, or it never came in the mail, which we hear from some voters, or you spoiled it, you can get a replacement ballot at your polling place if you have that ballot with you. If you don't have it, then they will issue you a vote by mail. I'm sorry, issue you a provisional ballot, and it will take a little bit longer to cast your ballot because you're going to need to fill out an envelope that provides your information on the outside of the envelope and your signature, and they will use that information to verify your status as a voter and use your signature to verify that you are a valid voter. And once they've done that and made sure you didn't cast a ballot some other way, if you are legally registered, they will count your ballot.
Okay, and just another quick question. We had a caller during our last hour who said that he has heard some counties don't have the money to count all provisional ballots. Is that true?
No, that's not true. Although counties do have varying election resources, and some counties do more than others, but every county is obligated to process their provisional ballots and count the ones that they can lawfully count. And in California, in the last election, from the counties that we looked at, we were able to look at provisional ballot data from the majority of counties in the state. And on average, about 85% of the provisional ballots that are cast in California, at least in the last election, were counted. So if you are stuck casting a provisional ballot, don't fret over it. Don't get stressed out about it. Make sure you fill out the envelope completely. You can go online afterwards and check to see if it was counted. But chances are good that it will get counted as long as you are a valid voter. And that's true regardless of what county you live in.
Billy writes in, did all the votes get counted during the California primary in June?
Yeah, there's this, on every election it seems there's this rumor that goes around that, you know, the elections officials purportedly stop counting ballots once the results are decided, and that is just not true. I mean, every legal vote that's cast is counted. Now, some vote-by-mail ballots and provisional ballots get rejected because the signatures don't match or the voter forgot to sign the envelope that the ballot is placed in, and in those instances, election officials cannot count those ballots. And similarly, if you get your vote-by-mail ballot in too late, they're not going to count it. Now, we changed a law in California to give voters a grace period, and as long as your ballot is postmarked by election day and received within 3 days of the election, it will get counted. And that has helped dramatically reduce the number of ballots that do get rejected in California. In the primary election, when this was the first statewide election this law took effect, in my own county, there were 8,000 ballots that came in that window of time between Wednesday and Friday that were postmarked by election day and that were able to be counted. But all ballots that are legally cast, whether they're vote by mail, polling place, or provisional ballots, do get counted.
All right. Thank you for that email, Billy. Today we're speaking with Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation, a nonpartisan organization working to improve the election process so it better serves the needs and interests of voters. And Kim, we've got full lines, lots of questions for you. Let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Let me turn the radio down. I was confused about Proposition 65 and 67, which are the plastic bag propositions. And Cross Currents this morning covered it, had it on the station. But I'm still confused because apparently the environmentalists support 67, which is a ban on plastic bags, and the bag industry supports and promote and put forth actually 65, which is directing the money toward environmental causes. But I'm wondering what happens if both pass, and the cross currents thing didn't mention that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and a lot of us are wondering what will happen if both pass. And you have it right. Your description was correct. So Prop 67 is an attempt. It's a referendum, and it's important for voters to know that a referendum is the opposite of an initiative. A lot of people just vote no on every initiative because they don't trust the initiative process, or that's how, you know, how they make their decisions. But on referendum, if it's a referendum, then a no vote is actually a yes vote. So with a referendum, you're being asked if you want to repeal a law or if you want to retain a law, and a yes vote keeps the law that the legislature enacted, in this case the plastic bag ban. A no vote repeals the law. So it's really counterintuitive, because the proponents of Prop 67 are the opponents of Prop 67. And then, to confuse matters even more, some say deliberately they also qualified another measure for the ballot, Prop 65, which directs the funds that are raised for plastic, for bag purchases from grocers, to go to this environmental fund, as the caller mentioned. Some people say that's just a diversion tactic. And the big question in my mind, and we're not going to know this until after the election, is whether Prop 65 is able to impact the plastic bag ban law. Even if 67 is passed and the plastic bag ban is upheld, if 65 also passes, there's a chance that it could impact the outcome of Prop 67 too. And frankly, I don't fully understand how that could happen, but I've checked with several people who have confirmed that it is possible that this initiative could impact this other referendum. So like is the case often with initiatives, we're not going to know the final results sometimes until after it's over and the court fights begin, which is another thing we're hearing about Prop 63, that there hasn't been a big campaign against the gun restriction and ammunition restriction initiative from the gun rights lobby. And I have heard reports that they're holding their fire, so to speak, until after the election to possibly file court challenges.
Wow, again, it's so confusing. So 67 would basically, the statewide policy on a plastic bag ban would be upheld with Prop 67. And just to make it kind of clear, people who want plastic bags banned are supporting 67 and opposing 65. They include the Californians Against Waste, Environment California, the Sierra Club, and they have not raised any money. Those who do not want plastic bags banned support 65, oppose 67. Those include Hilux Poly, Formosa Plastic, Superbag Corporation, and they have raised $6 million. According to CalMatters.org, if both measures pass, 65 would only be enacted if it receives more votes than 67. If voters reject 67, then Prop 65 does not apply. CalMatters.org does a great job of explaining this. Listen to the Cross Currents report and then head over to calmatters.org and check it out. So important. And Kim, so many people get frustrated with the process because it's so confusing.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important for people to remember, you don't have to vote on everything on the ballot. You know, voting is not a test. And I hear from a lot of voters, they get understandably very upset and stressed out when they realize after they voted that they voted opposite of the way they would have liked to have voted if they'd understood the measure better. So, you know, of course, we want everybody to vote on everything if possible. But if you're not confident, it's perfectly fine to skip a contest and move on to the next one. It's not going to invalidate your ballots. And there's a fair amount of voter confusion about that. We get this question a lot. So we want to make sure people realize that. It's our number one tip on our tip sheet for voters this year.
All right. Well, thank you, Judy. I hope that helps. And be sure to check out that resource, CalMatters.org.
Yeah,
let's go
resource.
Next to... Yeah, great resource. Ruth Ann in Berkeley. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Good morning. What I was wondering is that in the past there was a lot of negative press about voting on electronic machines and that the votes didn't get tabulated and that they got stolen, et cetera, and so forth, going back as far as 2000. But what I've since heard, and I wanted the guest's opinion on, is that there's a greater chance for fraud. So I used to vote paper ballot by mail. But then I learned that there was a greater chance for fraud with mail-in ballots than voting on machines, and I'm just not sure which is the safer route to go.
They both come with some risk, but all of our voting methods in California are safe, in my view. We did get rid of paperless electronic voting in California, and that was an unsafe voting method, in my view, and the view of a lot of other people, including the California legislature, which unanimously passed a law requiring a voter-verified paper trail to accompany any electronic ballot. So there is some electronic voting in California. Two counties, Orange County and San Mateo County, use electronic machines in their polling places countywide. Those machines all have a voter-verified paper trail that the voter can view before finishing their vote and leaving the polling site. And we also have a post-election manual tally of those ballot, those paper records, that we make sure that the computer count does match a hand count. So I'm confident that we, in all of our systems, we've made a lot of measures to make them secure. Vote by mail, you know, you hear a lot of talk, especially this election, about, you know, rigged elections and voter fraud. We really don't see that in California. We don't see people stealing people's ballots. We don't see people signing other people's names or coercing people to vote certain ways through vote by mail. So there are risks inherent in any remote voting system, anytime people are voting outside a polling establishment. But we have done a good job, I think, in California of minimizing those risks. And we don't hear a lot of reports from voters or law enforcement agencies, criminal prosecutors, about attempts to commit this kind of fraud. Now, I am worried about other states. I will be honest with you. I mean, there are a couple of states that are using paperless electronic voting, including, you know, many jurisdictions in Pennsylvania, which is a swing state. And so, you know, there are places that we do need to watch it more closely. They may not have the post-election manual count law that we do. And there are some risks out there in other states that I am concerned about.
Wow, we should do a show about that. Where do you go for your news about that, Kim?
There's a great story in the New York Times I just tweeted out today about five possible ways the election could be hacked or there could be problems. And it puts the risks in context, which I think is a really good thing for people to see. I mean, we have seen attempts to break into state voter registration databases this election, and that's a real threat. We also saw that a distributed denial of service attack recently that took down, you know, the internet for a big part of the day that Friday a couple weeks back. And that is the kind of thing that could also happen on election day that may not impact people voting but may impact people's ability to look up their polling place online or find information online or find the phone number for their county election office. You know, so those are things I am concerned about.
Well, we'll definitely find that New York Times piece and put a link at yourcallradio.org. Thank you again for calling. Really important question. Let's go next to Mary in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question. I really hope to have an answer for me. I want to know if there's a website I can go to find who's behind the proposition, where the money's coming from.
Yes. There are some great resources, and maybe, Rose, you can link to our top 10 online resources for California voters, which is on my blog. We have our website at calvoter.org, and you'll find there our proposition song, which is not going to help you follow the money, but it will help you get oriented to all 17 measures on the ballot. But if you want to dig deeper, there are some great resources out there. I love Voters Edge, which is provided by the League of Women Voters of California and MapLight, and that's at votersedge.org. And it's really this great one-stop shop where you can go in, enter your address, they will provide you with a list of every contest that's on your ballot, and then you can drill down and see how much money has been raised for each side or by each candidate and where is it coming from. And who are the sources? Is it in-state or out-of-state? And you can also read newspaper articles and access all the official information for candidates. You can get their statements, their positions. It's really helpful for those down-ballot contests, like judicial contests and local contests that are on our ballot that we really don't get a lot of information about. And, in fact, when it comes to voting on judges, because it's free for candidates to put their information into Voters Edge, I don't give candidates my vote if they haven't provided information to Voters Edge. I kind of use it as a litmus test. But I also love this other site, California Choices, cachoices.org, and they have a great, very simple grid chart that shows all these different organizations from all over the political spectrum, and will show you measure by measure whether they support or against those state propositions. So that's a great shortcut. In our voter guide at calvoter.org, if you go onto our California Online Voter Guide, which we've been producing online for 22 years now, it was one of the very first internet election websites back in 1994. And for each proposition, we do link in to the Fair Political Practices Commission's top 10 donors list that they're now maintaining for and against every proposition on the ballot. So there are a lot of resources out there now to help you follow the money and to make it easy to do. But they're all
and
online,
Kim,
so you got to get online to do that.
Since you've been doing this for so long, providing such a great public service, what strikes you about just how the amount of money being spent has grown and grown over the years?
I mean, it is striking that there's so much money in our campaigns, and the TV ads bear that out. What I've been really thinking about is, you know, it's a lot of money. Like, you look at something like Prop 61, the initiative that deals with drug pricing, where you've got the pharmaceutical industry spending, you know, they've put in over $110 million last time I looked to oppose this measure, and their ads are everywhere, and you see these contributions from these drug companies like Merck, you know, donating $9 million, and it sounds like so it is a lot of money in the political world, but it's a drop in the bucket in the pharmaceutical industry world, and it's really high stakes. I mean, what I find interesting this election is that measure, and I think a couple other ones on the ballot, I would say, you know, are high stakes, not just because California is a big state, but because that industry in particular, I think, is worried that if California voters did pass Prop 61, it could lead to more drug price control efforts by governmental agencies. And so they, understandably, many interest groups are concerned about what California voters do because we have so much influence nationwide and even internationally as a state. You know, people say as California goes, so goes the nation. So as much as people get frustrated about voting on initiatives, I know it can be challenging. I hope that voters also realize they have a great deal of power, and that's really what motivates me to do the work that I do, to help educate voters online and improve the voting process so people can vote with confidence, because we do, as California voters in the initiative process, have an extraordinary amount of power.
Kim Alexander is the president of the California Voter Foundation, a nonpartisan organization working to improve the election process for all of us. And we should also note, Kim, that people who became citizens after October 24th have the right to take their ID and proof of citizenship to their polling place or city hall and vote.
Yeah, and if you want to do it the best way, I mean, going to your county election office ahead of time is really what I would recommend. If you have any special needs or issues that you need addressed, your county election office is the place to go, and they're open during business hours. Some will be open over the weekend. You can vote in person at your county election office now if you're not going to be available on election day and it's too late to get a vote by mail ballot. And if you have a mail ballot and you want to send it in by the mail, I highly recommend you mail it by tomorrow. Otherwise, walk it in person to your election office or to your polling place or any polling place in your county on election day.
All right. Any final thoughts before we let you go, Kim?
Just, you know, great information online if you're stuck. And, you know, the other thing about this election that's really special is it's our first real big social media presidential election. And it's been really exciting to see how much influence individuals have among their friends and family by utilizing social media tools. And so I think that's exciting. I really encourage people to share what they learn with their friends. Make sure that you're, you know, using good sources. Don't pass on confusing information, because that can make things worse. But there are a lot of great resources out there, and I know from our perspective, social media has really helped us get our resources out to voters in a way that's unprecedented this year.
Kim Alexander is founder and president of the California Voter Foundation. Kim, thank you for joining us, and thank you for the public service you provide. You've been doing it for a long time, and it's so important. Thank you.
Thank you, and come visit us at calvoter.org.
All right. We have that on our website. The easiest way to find it is if you go to kalw.org, scroll down, you will see today's show, click on that, and then all of the resources will be there. Coming up after the break, we will specifically talk about what's on the San Francisco ballot, a really long one this year. We'll be joined by San Francisco Examiner reporter Joe Fitz Rodriguez. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to a Your Call election special, the final one before we go into voter week. If you've got something you've always wondered about the Bay Area, we want to hear your questions about your city or town. You can head to KLW.org and look for the box that says, Hey Area, type in your question, and we'll take the best questions and assign a KLW news reporter to investigate the answer. And we'll report what we learn back here on KLW. Coming up at noon, it's Bina from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Stay with us.
This is a special election edition of Your Call, and Election Day is almost here, just 5 days left. And if you are free on election night and you want to be around friends and our community, we hope you can join us at the Roxy Theater. It's a free event. We'll be live with results broadcasting. We'll be talking with The Intercept's Lee Fong, Antonia Yuhas. Actually, I saw Antonia here at Standing Rock, so we'll talk about that. Scott Horton of Harper's Magazine, Dave Leventhal of the Center for Public Integrity will bring you independent analysis live from 7 to 9 at the Roxy. That's 3117 16th Street in the Mission. Doors open at 6:30. And then Ben Trefney will be hosting a special call-in election night show back at KALW from 9 to 11 p.m. So I hope you can join us for both of those events. I always say that it'll be good to be around our community and have a group hug after some of the things that we've had to endure over the past year. So now we're going to talk about the San Francisco ballot. It's a huge ballot, 25 measures. We are voting for supervisor, city college, BART races, and helping us to review some of these measures and races is San Francisco Examiner reporter Joe Fitz Rodriguez. He covers City Hall and transportation for the paper, and Joe is also in the new documentary called Company Town, which I hope you can see. We did a show about that just a couple of weeks ago. Hey, Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
And well, great to have you.
That just got extended for a longer run in San Francisco. So if anyone wants to see it, it's at the Roxy, I believe, until the 9th now.
Oh, great. Yeah, so it's at the Roxy, Company Town. Really good documentary about what's happening here in San Francisco. It focused on the supervisor race between Aaron Peskin and Joe, her name escapes me. Can you help
Julie,
me out?
Julie Christensen.
Thank you, and Julie Christensen. Really, really good documentary. So, Joe, you have been closely following so many measures, the race between Jane Kim and Scott Wiener. There's so much more money being poured into that. It's getting really ugly. What are you covering right now? What are you really following closely?
Oh, my. I mean, there's so much that it's really, there's a smorgasbord of shady money to follow, and that's really the tale behind all of this. So, you know, of the 25 propositions on the ballot for San Francisco, of all the supervisors running, of the state Senate candidates, really a lot of the stories, actually very similar to the film Company Town you just referred to, is that a lot of tech money is coming in right now into these races. Tech money, real estate money, money from Big Soda, it's all flooding in right now.
Can you tell us what strikes you about the tech money that's flooding in? Where is it going?
Yeah, it's going a few different places. So, you know, very interestingly, Ron Conway, the billionaire angel investor who kind of propped up Facebook and a number of other startups that grew large, like Twitter, and he's been a strong ally of Airbnb. He's often called the godfather of Silicon Valley. He sent out a letter to all of an email to all of his angel invested companies, all the tech companies of Silicon Valley, told them who and what he wanted them to vote for. And a lot of that is reflected in his money. A lot of that is reflected in money from other tech oligarchs here in the Bay Area who, you know, it has been long rumored that he's kind of the corraler, right? He's saying, hey, Sean Parker, past president of Facebook, why don't you donate $200,000 or $250,000 to defeat some of these ballot propositions aimed at Mayor Ed Lee? And lo and behold, you see $250,000 coming in to fight these ballot propositions. So there's a number, and most of them are the easiest way to follow it is if the mayor supports it, if Mayor Ed Lee supports it, if the person is an ally of Mayor Ed Lee, then the tech money is flowing in. That's just the easiest way to put it.
And is there a good website that follows the money specifically in San Francisco? I've gone to the Department of Elections website, but that one is really difficult to wade through.
Yeah, if you go to, to get like a really easy breakdown, you know, it's been really doing great graphs and stuff. And first of all, check out sfexaminer.com today for a great story on tech money influencing local elections by my colleagues Josh Sabatini and Michael Barba, who did a fantastic breakdown. $1.8 million spent in third-party spending, kind of similar to like PACs on a national level. These are called independent expenditures locally, and that's $1.8 million in money, a lot of it from tech and real estate, supporting a lot of different local candidates. I mean, think of this, seriously, $700,000 to support a supervisor candidate, Asha Safai, running in District 11 of San Francisco, that's like kind of the south side, Ingleside, less than 44,000 voters, $700,000 in outside money coming to influence that election.
Wow. Is that a record?
There are records being set right now. $1.8 million for total third-party spending is a record in San Francisco, and it's stunning. It is a jaw-dropping amount of independent expenditure money that's flooding in from tech, from real estate, and from outside. It's fascinating. And the whole reason, for those who maybe are less familiar with San Francisco politics, is the Board of Supervisors, which is what you call a city council in a county, has 11 members, and a 6-5 split right now, 6 more tilted toward progressives, maybe who might find themselves more aligned with Bernie, perhaps, and then 5 members that are more moderate, who are more kind of, you know, I'm with her types, right? And that split, people in tech, people in real estate want that split flip the other way, because the moderates tend to be a little friendlier to developers, a little friendlier to building. It's a philosophical difference. They believe that, you know, we need to build, whereas the progressives are more like, well, we need to build, but we also needed to target specifically more affordable housing. And there's a lot of other places where they come down on the other side of decisions politically. And tech and real estate want to make sure that balance of power on the board shifts. And for those who aren't in San Francisco, this is important too, because the housing and transportation issues that rock San Francisco affect your commute everywhere else in the Bay Area, affect the rental prices everywhere in the Bay Area. We're seeing people flee San Francisco's skyrocketing rental prices to Oakland and Berkeley and everywhere. So, you know, even if you're not in San Francisco, these races should matter to you because this affects you too.
Yeah, it's so true. Malihe Razazan, senior producer, sent me a photo of her Bay Bridge commute this morning. I mean, sometimes she has to leave 2.5 hours early because it's just getting worse by the month.
Well, and that's the thing that strikes me, you know, Rose, is like, you know, we all want to talk about Trump, and we all want to talk about the important things happening nationally, but a lot of these local elections and decisions, they affect you in a very real, tangible way that you can touch. This affects your commute, this affects your rents, this affects the potholes, this affects the amount of homeless people who are living on the street or can find housing. It affects your health. I mean, the soda tax is a huge one. I mean, you know, is San Francisco going to tax sugary beverages? Well, the American Beverage Association is spreading at least $20 million supporting indirectly candidates that are against the soda tax, and they're spending to oppose the soda tax. It's a stunning amount of money.
Joe Fitz Rodriguez is a reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. He covers City Hall and transportation. He's also a columnist, and he's in the new documentary Company Town. We did a show about it a couple weeks ago, and I'm glad to hear that it's been extended at the Roxy. You can see it still in theaters, and it focuses on everything Joe was just talking about. If you have any questions for Joe about what we're voting on here in San Francisco. Like he said, so many of these issues affect everyone who lives in the Greater Bay Area. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have an email who, let's see, James says, are there contribution reports that are only due 3 days before the deadline for voting that some voters might want to see before casting their vote as a fully informed voter?
You know, the late contributions continue to come in right under the wire, and some won't even be revealed until after the election takes place, which is really unfortunate for the voters. There are late contribution filings. You can see them at www.sfethics.org, and they actually have a great kind of, you know, if you enter their campaign finance database, which is kind of at this little bar at the top, even though there are a lot of forms that are turned in and there's a lot of complicated stuff you have to wade through, they do actually have a fantastic set of bar graphs and visualizations and pie charts and very easy stuff to look through. It's all very responsive. You can click in and you can see how much independent expenditure money is being spent, and that's updated fairly regularly, even up to the last day of the election. So you really got to check it out and follow the money for yourself. I find it fascinating. Some of the biggest amounts of tech money are going to fight propositions D, H, L, and M in San Francisco, and those are seen by progressives who put them on the ballot as kind of good government reform measures to kind of even out the balance of power in San Francisco. San Francisco has what we call a strong mayor system. The mayor has a lot of influence over the body politic that isn't represented in other cities in the United States, where there's perhaps a more even distribution of power. You know, he can make appointments to different bodies and the like. D, for instance, would constrict his mayor's ability to make appointments to the Board of Supervisors when someone leaves office. For instance, Jane Kim and Scott Wiener, who are supervisors, are running for state senate. Well, one of them is elected. The way it is now, the mayor will be able to appoint someone to the board of supervisors. That shifts the balance of power and affects all of the votes on things that we just talked about, housing, transportation, everything. So it's an incredible power. And when that incumbent runs, they have the power of incumbency. I have a record. I did this, and this for you. And it, for the most part, in San Francisco's history, in more than 30 years of voting for supervisors, those incumbents have, by and large, won their re-election. So it's an incredible power that Proposition D would restrict and create special elections. Proposition H would create a public advocate that would kind of like investigate city hall matters on behalf of the public. You know, you can't get that pothole filled, the public advocate is going to figure out why. You can't, you know, too many parking tickets happening in your neighborhood, they're going to make those inquiries. And they have a lot of powers that other folks in government don't have to uncover these things. L would constrict the mayor's ability to appoint to the transportation agency, the SFMTA, and make it a split appointments, which right now they're all mayoral appointments and tend to vote in line with what the mayor wants. And M is put forth by Supervisor Aaron Peskin and would create kind of a commission above the mayor's Office of Housing and the Department of Economic and Workforce Development, which sounds very wonky, but really they do a lot with affordable housing and they need oversight, and that's kind of the basics of it. And the moderates who oppose it and the tech money who's going in against it are kind of making the claim that, hey, this is just an attack on Mayor Ed Lee. They want to constrict what Mayor Ed Lee can do, but I find that to be an odd argument because this constricts the office of the mayor no matter who's in that office. So once Mayor Ed Lee is gone, even if, say, Aaron Peskin runs for mayor, this would affect him too. So it's a fascinating amount of propositions that are being spent against with that tech money.
Yeah, so much work to do, homework to do. The San Francisco Examiner and Joe Fitz Rodriguez has great reporting. SFPublicPress.org also looks at all these measures in a really easy to read way. And then KALW. Yeah, they do great work. And then the KALW.org, you will find our election guide there. Since you brought up the Jane Kim and Scott Wiener race, Joe, we had both of them on. And, you know, Jane Kim is accusing Scott Wiener of taking money from Chevron. Scott Wiener is accusing Jane Kim from taking money from Big Soda. A lot more money has been poured into these races. Give us the latest.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've been covering this a lot, especially the money between Jane and Scott. I've covered the Soto money backing Jane, and I've covered the money backing Scott. The money backing Scott is a lot of that tech money that we've talked about. It's also the realtor money and developers. The realtors, Association of Realtors especially, is one to watch out for. They opposed repealing the Ellis Act statewide, repealing it, but modifying the Ellis Act statewide. You know, the mayor and Senator Mark Leno, went to the Capitol to kind of argue for, like, hey, we need to modify this. We need to help San Francisco renters. San Francisco renters are under a lot of pressure. There's a lot of evictions in San Francisco right now. And the Association of Realtors fought back, and they fought back hard. And those same Association of Realtors are really heavily backing Scott, and that's important. I just saw this really funny post, a post from a local Politico who ran for mayor, Quentin Mekki, a long while back. And he said, if you ask Scott Wiener what he thinks about housing, he says, did you know Jane is backed by Soda? If you ask Scott Wiener what he thinks about transportation, he says, do you know Jane Kim is backed by Soda? And it's kind of true. Scott is got a lot of great positions, but he's really focusing and hammering in on Jane Kim's Soda tax money, where, you know, he is deflecting a lot of accusations about the tech money and the realtor money, and saying that money isn't going to influence him and he's going to be independent when he's at the state level. And if he's going to attack Jane on the Soda money, then he's got to take some criticism on the realtor money and the development money and the tech money that's flooding in to back him. And interestingly, you know, if you're keyed in to national politics more than local politics, Hillary is backing Scott Wiener, and Bernie was heavily stumping for Jane Kim. So you can get kind of an idea of their politics from their national backers. For those who
and I noticed
kind of crib notes
that on the Democratic Party slate, you've got Feinstein, Kamala Harris, the big Democrats. Well, even Mark Leno is backing Scott Wiener.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, because Mark Leno's politics don't really align with Scott Wiener. In fact, since he announced his backing of Scott Wiener has gone against some of, not quite gone against, but had positions opposed to some of Mark Leno's measures. For instance, bringing more sunshine to police officers who are in officer-involved shootings statewide. You know, those names are often hidden. Those names are in disciplinary actions, and those names are often kind of behind a wall. You can't figure out who was in these disciplinary actions with police officers. Mark Leno wanted to reveal that, had that revealed at the state level, and Scott Wiener opposed it. And Scott Wiener has consistently opposed things that Leno's forced. And that's been an interesting one. There's been some talk about what political alliances may have been at play, or if just simply Mark Leno is backing Scott because he agrees with him on other positions and because Scott was his protege for a while. So it is an interesting kind of flip. And Scott Wiener's really been on the attack lately. Jane and Scott both have been on the attack lately. The ads have gotten a lot more aggressive. There was even, and this is potentially going to be in a future column of mine, a lot of ads in Chinese language newspapers that you don't see in English language newspapers. And that I think has been fascinating. I've been asking friends of mine that can translate for me, or, you know, sources of mine who can translate for me. And, you know, in Chinese language newspapers, supporters of Scott Wiener have been attacking Jane Kim for her dating life, for her romantic life. There was a story that Matiran Ross broke a while back, and I'm not sure how much I agree with this kind of reporting, but talking about who someone on the state level she was dating, and that potentially, you know, a marriage may have ended as they were dating. In Chinese language ads, in Chinese language newspapers, supporters of Scott Wiener have been calling out Jane Kim for breaking up a marriage.
Wow.
That's the level we've gotten to at this point.
Joe Fitz Rodriguez is a reporter with the San Francisco Examiner covering City Hall and transportation. If you have any questions for Joe about what's on the San Francisco ballot, lots of important measures, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Dee in San Francisco.
Yeah,
hi, Dee.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rose. I'm feeling like a voice in the wilderness here about one of the propositions, Proposition C on the ballot, which purports to be making affordable housing. Well, what it does is take leftover earthquake money from a prior bond and put some of it towards, most of it towards these renovations on unspecified properties. And by the way, speaking of money coming in, Kilroy Realty and a bunch of other out-of-town people are investing in this, are putting money into the campaign. And so what will happen is hundreds or thousands of unsuspecting tenants are going to be uprooted and put into some other place while their places are redone. The places are going to be renovated, whether they need it or not. And the various architects and contractors are going to be making plenty of money off it. And I'm talking from having had it done to me, and I know what it's like. And it's only one step worse than being evicted. You're not on
I'm
the
sorry.
Street.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Dee. Thank you for calling. We actually have an email from Denise on this one. And she says C is a cash cow for gentrification. She sent us a number of funders for C, Mariposa Development of Irvine, as Dee said, Kilroy Realty of L.A. There's Nibby Brothers Associates, PG&E, $25,000. What can you tell us about C, Joe? Joe, do we have you there? Did we lose Joe?
Oh.
Uh-oh. Did we lose Joe? All right. Well, why don't we reconnect with... We did lose Joe. Okay, so we'll reconnect with Joe, and I will read the description of Proposition C at sfpublicpress.org, just so we don't leave you hanging here. This measure would provide funding to rehabilitate, buy, or build affordable housing by redirecting unused bond authority San Francisco voters granted in 1992 to loan money to property owners for seismic upgrades. If passed, the measure would cause the city to incur new debt that would be repaid through property taxes. According to the controller's office, the city's debt management policy would direct it to issue these bonds while maintaining the city's property tax level to not exceed the 2006 property tax rate, and the board voted 11-0 to put this initiative on the ballot. Joe, are you back with us?
We're back. Yeah.
Okay.
We're
still Prop C. Yep.
Yeah. So C was interesting because, you know, this money has not been touched for a long time, and this money was found as, you know, the good government types and advocates were kind of looking through different pots of money that hadn't been spent, and you know, this type of renovation happens all the time, and it will happen, I mean, regardless of whether C passes. So C is just finding more money in order for it to be done.
All right. Well, what about the concerns that real estate interests and developers are putting money into C?
So C is really being pushed actually by the affordable housing developers, not like the kind of luxury housing developers that we talk about when we talk about development money. The Council of Community Housing Organizations, TODCO, a number of other folks like that are the type of folks that are backing C. These are the folks who build affordable housing for like the neediest San Franciscans at the lowest income brackets. So when they generally push for money to rehabilitate housing, it's I usually don't find it as high a red flag as when a luxury developer says, hey, give us this money.
All right. Important distinction. Well, thank you for calling, and thanks for the email. Let's go next to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Joe. Thanks for the show. I wanted to just pick up on the point that Joe's making about big money and local politics and following the money and also looking at questions of power and inequality when we vote. I think it's really critical that we not just it is a bunch of equivalents. Well, this person's taking this money, this person's taking that money, and they're all getting ugly and they're all fighting. And I know Joe's not saying that, but I think it's easy to get kind of overwhelmed by that overall sense, when in reality there are certain candidates and propositions that are may not be perfect, but that are very clearly about balancing power and addressing inequality and affordability. So I think it's just really key looking at some of the local supervisor races, to really focus in on people's actual records and what they've actually stood for. And, you know, I have an article in the Examiner yesterday, The City's Identity at Stake, on November 8th, if people want to look at it, that sort of brings out some of these ideas.
I'm really glad you raised this, Chris, because when we were talking about money with Jane Kim and Scott Wiener, I was thinking, all right, let's talk about where they differ on policy. And Chris, would you hold, please? Malihei Razazan, senior producer, wants to chat with you for a minute. But thank you for bringing that up. What about that, Joe? The money is obscene, overwhelming. People are angry about it. But the policy differences are very important, and they often get lost when we talk about the money.
Yeah, I think you're very right. I think, you know, there's a lot of great coverage of some of that out there. I highly recommend taking a look at some of the Examiner's pieces about Jane Kim and Scott Wiener. My colleague Josh Sabatini has written a lot of great stuff about their policy differences. But one of the biggest ones is in housing. I mean, there is a different tact to be taken in building housing in San Francisco and statewide. Scott Wiener and Jane Kim both believe that they want to be solving the housing crisis, but both have very different ideas of how to do it. Scott Wiener's idea is that, you know, we need to lower the barriers to create housing. You know, he wants to remove some of what he calls the red tape, but what Jane Kim and others might call a means of negotiation. Jane Kim has been part of a number of negotiations in her district, which is District 6, which includes south of Market in San Francisco, to negotiate when these high-rises are built that more than necessary affordable housing is built. And she's really arm-wrestled with these guys. She's not always been successful, but she's often been successful at arm-wrestling a lot of affordable housing out of these individual deals. And the idea that in each and every deal there can be more affordable housing is one that permeates a lot of her policy and a lot of what she's done in terms of housing. Scott Wiener, on the other hand, has a strong belief that if you just build as much as you can, wherever you can, it's going to eventually relieve the housing costs. I think Jane's ideas incorporate a bit of that, but also incorporate the need to have more tenant protections and on the local level. And I think it's important that when we talk about housing, which is, of course, the keyest issue in San Francisco, we talk about Ted Gullickson, who is a former head of the tenants union in San Francisco.
And we have just about 30 seconds, Joe.
Oh, sorry. And who died a few years ago. And, he really was bitterly against Scott Wiener's housing policies. And I fully endorse you guys, research Ted Gullickson, research Scott Wiener.
Joe Fitzgerald is a reporter with the San Francisco Examiner covering City Hall and transportation. And Joe, hats off to you. You have done such a great job in this election. Thank you so much for your reporting.
No, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. You can find all of the shows that we've done over the past couple of months and Cross Currents reports on the election at kalw.org. We hope you can join us on election night for a free event at the Roxy. The doors open at 6:30. We'll be live from 7 to 9. And then Ben Trefney will be back at KALW for a special call-in show from 9 to 11 p.m. That is on election night, just 5 days left. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening.
On this week's Open Air, I'll talk with the Peninsula Symphony's music director, Mitchell Klein, about the orchestra's concerts this weekend, featuring pianist Conrad Tau and composer Carolyn Bremer, who will also join me in studio. Plus, we'll hear about this weekend's concerts offered by the Golden Gate Symphony and Chorus from music director Urs Leonhardt and soprano soloist Yi Triplett. It's Open Air Thursday afternoon at 1. I'm David LaTulipe. Join me here on KALW.